Pete is also his captain, Pete. So, okay, last round.
Well, on R&D and innovation, I agree with the comments that have been made, and therefore I did not quite understand the reaction of Chris. So maybe he could clarify a little bit more on that. I think that if we are developing energy options that do not have a market, let's say within 5 years, there's hardly any interest from the perspective of companies to invest. And when looking for a sustainable energy economy, we need tremendous investments in development of technologies in this direction. And that means that if companies are not going to invest, the government should do it. And in my view, the development of wind, of biomass, of photovoltaics shouldn't have take place without the investments or in the investments of the government, and that's still the case. If you look to the spendings, as indicated by Annemarie Goedmakers, the spendings of the, for example, the energy companies, but in general, partly as a result of the privatization and liberalization of energy markets, the willingness of energy companies, at least in for example, in Europe, is less, much less than in the past to invest in innovation. And when, well, another issue when discussing, for example, what the European Union is doing, as I indicated, at present, the spendings on R&D globally are about $7.5 billion a year. It used to be, in dollars of 2000, about double that figure 25 or 30 years ago. So it's decreasing on the governmental side. The European Union altogether, all the countries together, are spending about $1.5 billion a year, and about $9.9 million is still on nuclear. So the focus is also in the European Union mainly on nuclear fusion and fission, and much less on, for example, energy savings and also the clean use of fossil fuels and renewables. So in my view, there should be a shift. I think that governmental intervention is needed, not only in terms of regulation, to stimulate the implementation and application of options that are already there. It's also needed to get a level playing field, to reduce subsidies that are still heavily taking place on fossil fuels and nuclear mainly. And that creates, that needs intervention, but not only on this side, also in terms, in my view, of energy R&D. So I did not quite understand why David, Chris was saying it's not important, the market will do it. They have to do it, but they don't do it, in my view, and we need a strong government in different perspectives.
Thank you.
Let me make an effort to just further clarify the point, and then maybe
briefly,
we...
Chris, because we are running out of time.
Yeah, I understand, and then we can continue over drinks.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not against R&D. I mean, R&D is going to be essential to advance all of these technologies. But I think most of it is going to need to be private sector R&D when you're talking about the commercial part of the energy system. Because if government R&D were really the answer to new energy systems, we would have a flourishing rather than a dead nuclear industry today, because we pumped billions of dollars in and we continue to pump enormous amounts of government money to very little effect. I mean, the companies take the government's money and they do relatively little with it. What you need to do is create the conditions for a market, have the private companies invest their own money, and then supplement it with some governmental R&D, as is already happening in bioenergy, in wind energy, in photovoltaics. There is government R&D involved, but it's a relatively small fraction in most of those sectors. But, you know, innovation and technology and R&D are critical. I mean, with wind, you've got literally a new generation of technology every 3 to 4 years. In photovoltaics now, it's every 2 years. Clearly, there's a tremendous innovation. It's entrepreneurial. It's not mainly the old line energy companies. It's the new entrepreneurial companies. So I think government needs to, rather than dump money in, needs to be very clever in opening up the private markets and then providing limited, targeted government R&D money.
To be continued later. Rudy, you have maybe some last comments.
Yes, there were several comments, in fact, on efficiency and productivity in agriculture, and it is very important to distinguish very clearly between the different areas around the world. The solutions in Europe won't work in Africa. And so we have to take into account that if you are working in Africa and try to increase food security and agriculture productivity, the major thing which has to happen is, in fact, to increase the productivity per hectare. And that's extremely low at this moment, extremely low. It has not increased over the last 20 years or so. And that is only possible when external inputs are being used. Because of the deteriorated soils at many places, the lack, in fact, of investment in agriculture and in soils, we have to invest now. If not, unsustainability spiral is continued. And means that you're outmining the soils, ultimately you're leaving and you're knocking down a tropical rainforest again. Now, that's threatening at several places. And on a world scale, you see that every year, only in South America, at least 20 times the cultivated area of the Netherlands is being knocked down as tropical rainforest just for that reason. And it's similar to in Africa. If we are capable of helping those in the developing world, the producer organizations, by investing in agriculture, it can be on a micro level with micro credits, having women invest in agriculture and investing in soils, then that can overcome that that dreadful situation. But it requires major programs which are fine-tuned to the specific needs in different countries and the specific needs of different groups in those countries. That's one. But if you look at the other hand, and that's the situation, for example, in Europe we have the possibility to fulfill our societal aims in terms of economic aims, environmental goals, nature goals, and social goals by making use of less land. In European Union, for example, we are using 140 million hectares, can be done by 50 million, but we can also reduce the amount of pesticides substantially. At this moment, 400 million kilograms of pesticides being used in the European community. It can be done with only 5 to 20 million kilograms. If you do the right agriculture, the right place, and at a high production level in those places where it can be done. And that's the same effect for nature conservation. Why is it not done? That's because there is a lot of inertia in our systems. And the inertia are determined by the short-term profit of individuals which don't see the dynamics which is necessary to transfer to a more sustainable agriculture system and to a more sustainable use of the nature resources. That has to be done, and it requires political will and political courage. That's not there at the moment, but when it's there, it could happen, it should happen, because society asks it and the possibilities are there.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think it's now time for some concluding remarks. on my own, I will not say very much. I think the new definition of global security as proposed in the report was shared almost by everybody this afternoon. I think it's clearly on the political agenda. I think the speeches by the Minister for Development Cooperation and the State Secretary made clear that at least as far as they are concerned, it's very much an item on the political agenda. On the policy cycle, having a thing on the agenda is one, but implementing it is another. And that's where the panel, became very clear in saying, these are the directions, but there are this discussion about the numbers, there's discussion about the instruments, should it be market, should it be the government, what vested interests cause the inertia, which block policy development. But at least the first step has to be made. It is on the agenda and it's a serious item in the political discourse nationally and internationally. I think that's a tremendous gain, and I'd like to congratulate the people from the World Watch Institute with presenting such a clear report, which brought this consensus about. Of course, the next debate will be very politically interesting and intensive as well. I will not say much more. I just would like to give Chris or Michael just the opportunity to say a few sentences how this meeting, how this event compared to the other events which they were present where they could present their reports in Washington or in Europe. Just a brief comment on that, and then we call it a day, and then we go to the real part of the symposium.
Well, thank you very much, and it really has been a very lively and interesting discussion. I find that we're always learning more things, and you know, one idea that just popped out in the discussion here is that we really should focus very specifically on the role of children and a sort of a child-friendly approach to development. I think that would be a wonderful chapter for a future edition of State of the World. One of the reasons we like to do these events is we come up with new ideas, and maybe you can even propose a person or people that might be interested in working with us in authoring such a chapter, because it would be wonderful to work with someone who has actual field experience on an issue like that. Well, I don't want to compare and contrast and, you know, by implication even criticize individual countries. I must say that throughout the countries that I've done presentations in, we've had a very positive and I think proactive response to this book. You probably won't be surprised that was the reaction in Geneva, or even that it was the case in Madrid. In Geneva, we had the head of the United Nations in Europe join us for the press conference. At a symposium similar to this one in Madrid, we had the relatively new environment minister. All were very positive and committed, I think, to a very similar agenda. What you may be surprised to hear is that we also had a very positive reaction in the U.S. Congress, where we did a symposium co-sponsored by both a Republican and a Democratic member of Congress. They were ones that were, you know, particularly sympathetic, I think, to some of the issues we're dealing with. I would not claim that all 435 members of the U.S. Congress are necessarily equally inclined. But I do get the sense that, you know, a different kind of wind is blowing even in Washington these days, that there's a recognition, and I think you saw that beginning to take place in terms of some of the framing of issues on President Bush's recent visit, that a broader approach to security issues has to be taken. I might just say, in sort of looking forward, I'm particularly looking forward to the launch of the Chinese edition this year, because we have a new partner in China. We think China is an absolutely critical country to be working in these days, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see the reaction of the Chinese on these issues, the degree of recognition of their problems, and also the degree of beginning to anticipate some of the solution. You know, there were zero environmental NGOs in China 5 years ago. Today there are 2,000. I mean, this is the most rapid growth of an environmental movement in world history, with the possible exception of India, which has also been moving very, very rapidly in this regard. So we are increasingly focusing our energies on outreach, you know, beyond Europe and North America, to the global south, to China, to India, to Africa, to Latin America, and the Middle East, and other parts of the world that are growing and changing in very, very important ways. So let me just add again my thanks to the Institute and its support of the event here today, to thank my fellow panelists. It's been a real pleasure to hear all of the thoughts and some of the differences of opinion, and also to thank all of you in the audience for joining us today. It's been a really productive meeting. Thank you.